Hello, folks. Welcome to the February 2019 edition of First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host as we go through the latest crop of recent cases of importance in the public safety workplace. But first, I've got to tell you how the premium podcast series is going, because I'm really very excited about this. It's been fun recording some of these interviews that we'll be offering on the premium podcast or through the premium podcast package. Now, just as some reminder, our regular podcasts, the regular First Thursdays, they'll continue to be free. But we are offering a second podcast each month through this premium podcast subscription. And you get that second podcast, and you also get a lot of other stuff for the price of, I think it's $9.95 or something like that, $99 a year. Let me put it that way. I'm not as good with business as I should be. So what do you get with the second podcast? First of all, you get PDF versions of five of our books. And these are all searchable. So if you come up with like a Garrity problem and want to learn more about the Garrity rule, you just pop in one of the books that discusses Garrity, and you'll see the origins and eventual development of the Garrity rule, whatever it might be. The books that you'll get PDF versions of are The Rights of Law Enforcement Officers, The Rights of Firefighters, Public Safety Collective Bargaining, which is our newest book, the FLSA, and the Family and Medical Leave Act. In addition, you'll get searchable online archives of our monthly newsletter, Public Safety Labor News, and you'll get a printable PDF version of the newsletter. Plus, you get a discount on seminar registrations and book orders, all of that for the $99 a year. If you want to spend a little bit more, we'll send you a hard copy of Public Safety Labor News. That's $150 a year. Okay, those details out of the way. What's been going on with these premium podcast interviews? Well, I've got several of them, as they say in Hollywood, I guess, that are in the can now. And I just love the way these interviews are going. I started by interviewing Margie Brogan, who is one of the preeminent arbitrators in the country. She's the immediate past president of the prestigious National Academy of Arbitrators. And we had a great time in the interview. The kind of the titular approach to the interview was that I posed to her five questions that the parties in arbitration would like to ask an arbitrator. But where it got into, I think, an awful lot of fun was one of those five questions was, what are the five things that the parties in arbitration do that irritate arbitrators? Just a great back and forth dialogue. I next interviewed Greg McGillivray. Greg is a partner in the Washington, D.C. law firm of Woodley and McGillivray. They're the lawyers for the IAFF internationally. But Greg, to me, is better known as a lawyer who handles Fair Labor Standards Act cases. He's handled over 400 of them, mostly for firefighters and law enforcement officers. And when you hear this thing, get ready. It is a total FLSA geek fest. I promise you. Greg, I don't have quite as much experience as Greg in FLSA cases, but I've done my share of them. And we get into all of the basics of the FLSA, how you calculate the overtime rate, where employers are getting that wrong in their built-in payroll systems. We'll talk about off-the-clock time, why that's a problem, and how courts are starting to approach the issue of use of electronic devices off-duty. So you, for example, might have a police detective who sends texts off-duty. Is that sort of thing compensable? Anyway, we talk about literally dozens of FLSA issues over the course of that interview. I've got two more that I've already recorded. One is with two lawyers, one from Kansas City, one from Connecticut. They are in the Ogletree Deacons Law Firm. Stacy Bunk is a partner in the Kansas City office, and John Stratton, a partner in the Stamford, Connecticut office. And what we do is to unravel a basic question about the FMLA. And it's more than one question, but it comes under one broad topic. And the topic is, when someone's off on FMLA leave, what stops? What has to continue happening? So we talk about things like, what happens to health insurance when someone's off on FMLA leave? Is there a different rule for life insurance and disability insurance? And oddly enough, yes, there is. What about seniority? Does it continue to accrue? What about leave benefits? Do they continue to accrue? What degree of communication can the employer have with the employee when they're off on FMLA leave? Those sorts of questions. And that was really a fun interview. Both John and Stacy, very well spoken, and it was just a real positive way of getting at what is sometimes quite a complicated law. And then the last of the interviews that I've recorded so far is with Christy Carroll. Christy is a union side attorney down in New Orleans, where being a union side attorney is not the easiest thing in the world to do. Under Louisiana law, employers can collectively bargain, but once a contract expires, they can just simply say, well, that was interesting, don't think we'll do that again, and not bargain anymore with the labor organization. Christy was the lawyer for the firefighters in a challenge over their promotional system. And this is a case where the employer went from basically having a rule of three, you've got to promote from the top three people on the list, to a rule of the list where the employer could pick anybody who was anywhere on the list. And this was a rank-ordered list that had about 140 people on it, and the employer, in fact, did skip over dozens and dozens of firefighters who were seeking promotion to the position of captain in order to get down into the 130s for its promotion. Christy unravels that case for us with the very interesting and definitely peculiar New Orleans background that you would expect. So at any rate, those are the premium podcasts that we've been recording. And as I said, I'm really excited about how this is going to turn out. These practitioners, in both from management and labor and arbitrators, they have really something to offer all of us. It's a much broader perspective than I can give you by myself, and I'm really looking forward to doing these in the future. Okay, on to the cases. I want to start with it's a small disciplinary case, small not in terms of the impact on the employee, but small in terms of the court's opinion, which is actually quite short. But it's about a pretty important issue, and it concerns the standard on appeals when a public safety employee is appealing a disciplinary sanction through the courts. Now, let's set the stage for this just a little bit. There are roughly 32 states in the country with statewide collective bargaining laws. I say roughly because there's a couple more that have laws just for firefighters, but not police. You know who you are, Colorado and Idaho. In those states, those 32 states, the primary, almost the exclusive means of appealing discipline is through binding arbitration. And with an arbitration system, the arbitrator's decision is essentially it. That's what binding arbitration means. Nobody appeals with any degree of success from an arbitrator's opinion. But in the 18 states without collective bargaining by state law, and in some of the states, the 32 states with bargaining, public safety employees, if they have any appeal rights at all, appeal through either civil service or a police and fire board, and then if they disagree with that decision, appeal into the courts. Sometimes they appeal directly into the courts. And the standard of review, when a court finally gets a disciplinary case in one of these situations, is, and I'm quoting here, substantial evidence. What this case is about that I'm about to describe is what that phrase, substantial evidence, means. And it is truly one of the misnomers in labor law. When you think of the phrase substantial evidence, you're thinking about a lot, right? There needs to be a bunch of evidence. It needs to be substantial. And as it turns out, the phrase substantial evidence is preciously close to the same thing as any evidence. So let's look at this case. This involved a police officer by the name of Maurice Conley, who worked for the City of St. Louis Airport Police Department in Missouri. He was fired for a 2014 incident in which he was alleged to have been untruthful. The incident actually, but for the untruthfulness, was really much ado about nothing. It dealt with what Conley did with an unattended bag at the airport. You know, whenever you're in an airport, you hear those warnings over the PA system, don't leave your bags unattended. Well, in the St. Louis airport, police officers end up picking those things up. Conley's problem was that he lied about what he did with the bag, and he lied to both dispatch and to another officer. He told them he had returned the unattended bag to its owner. In fact, he'd thrown it away. So the department fires him, and the city's Civil Service Commission upholds the termination. Conley appeals to the Missouri Court of Appeals, saying no substantial evidence for the termination. The court upholds Conley's termination. And after having read hundreds, if not thousands, of these cases involving the substantial evidence test, I can tell you that whoever it is who's doing the appealing, and sometimes it's employers, right, when they lose the case before civil service, whoever it is doing the appealing, I can pretty much predict with about, 99.4% accuracy that they're going to lose. Because if all they've got to say is substantial evidence, that's not saying much as far as the court is concerned. What's the court's response? Well, it begins by defining what substantial evidence is. The court says, for evidence to be substantial, it must be competent. That's a very low threshold in the law, and support the Civil Service Commission's discretionary determination. Substantial evidence is competent evidence that would have probative force upon the issues if believed. Okay, that's a fancy way of saying substantial evidence is any evidence where the person who is testifying actually is an appropriate witness for that evidence. It's any evidence that could be believed, is potentially believable on whatever issue it is the person is testifying about. In other words, you could have 90% of the evidence going one way and 10% going the other way. And if the trier of fact, be it a court or a civil service board or a police and fire board, believes the 10% of the evidence, that's substantial evidence. It could go 99% one way, 1% the other. And if the civil service board or whoever believes the 1%, that's the end of the case. Yeah, here's how the Court of Appeals winds up its opinion here. This court may not substitute its judgment on the evidence for that of the agency and must defer to the agency's determinations on the weight of the evidence and the credibility of witnesses. To the extent that the decision rests upon findings of fact, the court may not substitute its judgment for that of the agency. See what I mean when I say substantial evidence not only means any evidence, But if that's the only thing you've got to say, save the money on your lawyers. You are probably, almost certainly, going to lose. Next up is another disciplinary case. This is one from California, and it involves what's known as the Johnny's Poultry Rule. Yes, you heard that right. The Johnny's Poultry Rule. What is the Johnny's Poultry Rule? It's a rule of disciplinary procedure. It's kind of sort of disciplinary procedure, kind of sort of union representation rights, that asks this question. When the employer wants to interview bargaining unit members by way of preparing for arbitration, what does it have to say to the bargaining unit members? Are there specific warnings that it has to give? All right, so let's set the stage factually for this case. This comes to us from California's Public Employment Relations Board, which writes, among the most thorough and exhaustively reasoned opinions of any labor board in the country. So when we see a case come out from PERB down in California, it's one you'd want to typically pay a lot of attention to. This is not a public safety case, but it is a case that involves a public employer. And that employer is the City of Commerce, California, down in the Los Angeles area. And it has a collective bargaining agreement with the Commerce City Employees Association. And the city decides to terminate a member of the association's bargaining unit, a fellow named Sergio Mejia. And the grievance goes to arbitration. It's set for 2 non-consecutive days. And following the first day of hearing, the association asks the arbitrator for subpoenas for 2 bargaining unit members. Why would a union want to subpoena bargaining unit members? Either they might be reluctant to testify without a subpoena, or it could be they want to get paid for their time testifying in the arbitration, and it helps if you have a subpoena if that's the case. Whatever the motivation here, the arbitrator issues the subpoena, and these 2 employees are set to testify for the second day of the hearing. When the employer's attorney, a guy named Stephen Frieder, learns about the subpoenas, he says, I want to interview these 2 employees. The association objects. Frieder says, I'm going to proceed with the interviews 2 days later unless you give me authority that prevents me from conducting the interviews. And the association, for reasons I can't quite figure out from this opinion, never responds. In fact, Frieder goes ahead with the interviews. The 2 bargaining unit members asked for and got the union president to be present at the interviews. And Frieder talks to them about the general facts relating to the termination, and also asks them whether or not they knew why the association was calling them as a witness. Eventually, the arbitrator upholds the city's position on the termination, but the association files an unfair labor practice complaint challenging Frieder, the lawyer's, conduct. And California's PERB upholds the complaint and finds that Frieder and the city committed an unfair labor practice. Enter Johnny's Poultry, because the labor board in California has adopted in the past and reaffirms its belief in the Johnny's Poultry Rule in this case. So what's the Johnny's Poultry Rule? And in that case, the National Labor Relations Board said that whenever an employer's questioning of an employee occurs in preparing the employer's defense for trial in arbitration or some other sort of forum, the employer has to give specific warnings to the employee. What are those warnings? The employer has to tell the employee what the purpose of the questioning is, has to assure the employee that no reprisal will take place no matter what the employee's answers to the questions are, and must obtain the employee's participation on a voluntary basis. There are other aspects of the Johnny's Poultry rule as well. Questioning has to be in an environment, in a context that's free from employer hostility, has to be conducted in a non-coercive manner. And the questions can't exceed the legitimate purpose of preparing for the hearing, whatever the hearing is, by prying into other union matters, and can't get into information concerning, and I'm quoting here, an employee's subjective state of mind. All of those are warnings and dictates that an employer must comply with when seeking to interview a bargaining unit member in preparation for the employer's case in arbitration or wherever the appeal is being heard. Why? What's the whole thing? What is Johnny's Poultry all about? Why do we have this rule? Let me give you three sentences from Cal Perb's opinion that shows the underlying motivation for the rule. And I'm quoting, while negotiated pre-arbitration discovery may be desirable for facilitating settlement, this does not compel the kind of one-sided extra-contractual default rule that the City of Commerce advocates, a rule under which the employer may conduct pre-arbitration interviews under threats of discipline, but the union, which cannot compel the interviews of management witnesses, may not. More consistent with the purposes of our laws, this is Cal Perb speaking now, so the state of California's collective bargaining laws, is a rule requiring employers to follow Johnny's Poultry if they wish to interview represented bargaining unit members. This rule places the parties on more equal footing and encourages good faith bargaining over mutual pre-arbitration discovery rights. And then CalPERB puts an exclamation point on the end with this sentence. It takes courage to testify against one's employer in an arbitration hearing. And allowing the employer to interview an employee concerning the matter under threat of discipline has a self-evident tendency to deter employee participation in the arbitration process. And so a Perb ends up finding that, in fact, the city committed an unfair labor practice and tells the city, go ye forth and sin no more. Would this apply in other states where there's statewide collective bargaining? Yes, I think that's going to be the overwhelming inclination of state labor boards. Johnny's Poultry is an old case. It's decided in 1964. It's been around a long time. I would expect to see this same rule followed in any state where you have statewide collective bargaining. By the way, one little tag I want to put on my discussion of this case. Remember I said that the city's lawyer in this case, Frieder, told the association before he conducted the interviews, he said, hey, I'm about to do these interviews in 2 days. Unless you provide me with some authority as to why I don't have the right to do the interviews. And the association never responded. Did that issue come up, the association's failure to respond? Did that come up in the CalPERB's decision? And it did. And what the city argues is, look, while you objected to these interviews, you didn't answer our request for authority that would prohibit the interviews. Here's what CalPERB says about that. We recently rejected the notion that a union must educate an employer on its legal obligations. We do so here as well. You kind of expect a mic drop after that sentence, don't you? At any rate, the notion that the union had to respond and that thus the employer could be shorn of its liability for an unfair labor practice just simply didn't go very far with Okay, let's move down to Louisiana. As you might imagine from my comments earlier in this podcast, when you see Louisiana cases, get ready. It's going to be an interesting case one way or another because of the structure of the laws there. And one thing you need to understand about Louisiana law is that civil service boards in Louisiana are given a great deal of authority to investigate and administer the entire hiring and firing system. A lot more authority than you see in other parts of the country. And you'll see that in this case. And this case involves whether or not a police chief can be ordered to sign what's known as a POST waiver. POST, by the way, acronym for Peace Officer Standard and Training Waiver. In order to be a police officer in Louisiana, like every state in the country, you have to have some sort of certificate from a state licensing agency. That's POST in this case. So how does this case come up, and what's a waiver of POST certification all about? This involves a lieutenant, a guy named Mark Wheeler, a longtime lieutenant for the Shreveport Police Department. He'd worked there 25 years. He had to have some surgery on his feet in 2015, and it was non-job related, and so that required him to take sick leave. He expected to be off work in 6 weeks, but there were complications, and eventually he was off work about 7 months or so. Finally, in March of 2016, he was medically cleared to come back to work. He qualified with his firearm, and he was assigned to work in the property room, a lieutenant working in the property room. That probably gives you a signal that he may not be the favorite son in the Shreveport Police Department. Well, in Louisiana, POST certification is required to be completed every 13 months. And the department requires officers to complete their training during their birth month. And Wheeler's birth month is November. So he needed to complete his POST training while he was off on sick leave. Remember, he was off on sick leave for 7 months, and he didn't come back to work till March. So he needed to complete this training in November of 2015. Department policy didn't allow officers to attend training while on sick leave. And in fact, the city has a home confinement, sick leave confinement policy that requires officers who are using sick leave to be confined to their homes except for activities. I'm going to read you the exception list because it's interesting. Activities such as voting, religious activities, obtaining medication, medical care, rehabilitative or therapeutic exercise, other therapeutic exercise activities, and obtaining food or meals. So, yes, you can go out to eat if you're on sick leave in Shreveport. So Wheeler can't do the training. And in February of 2016, so this is a little bit, about a month before he returns to work, he gets a letter from the city saying, hey, you haven't completed your training. You have until March 31 to complete the training. The letter from the city also says you have the ability to get a waiver, a POST waiver, instead of the training. You just have to apply for the waiver from POST, but you have to get the chief's signature approving of the waiver request. The chief refused to sign the waiver, and Wheeler's POST certification was revoked. Now, anywhere but Louisiana, what would a lieutenant or an officer do under these sorts of circumstances? You might appeal through POST. You might file a lawsuit. Neither one might be a very good remedy, I would think. But in Louisiana, you have this kind of bulked up civil service system. And what Wheeler does is he files a petition with the city's civil service board saying, will you order the police chief to sign the waiver? And the civil service board does that. And then the city files an appeal in the Louisiana Court of Appeals, arguing that the Civil Service Board didn't have the authority to give such an order. And the court disagrees with the city and says, look, in Louisiana, civil service boards have the authority to investigate the administration of personnel and personnel decisions. And I'm quoting now, simply put, the board is authorized to take any action in the exercise of its duties and responsibilities that does not contravene or violate the law. We find no provision of the law prohibiting the board from ordering the chief to sign a waiver, especially under these circumstances. And then the court goes on a little bit to say, look, the reason the board is investigating here is because the chief did something very unusual. He refused to sign a post waiver for a veteran employee, 25 years, with a valid excuse for needing the waiver. Back to the court's opinion. In our view, when a veteran officer loses his certification and ultimately his badge under circumstances that could have been avoided, that issue falls under the Civil Service Board's authority. So at any rate, interesting case, again, out of Louisiana with its unusual civil service system, but shows the power that a civil service board there in Louisiana has. Okay, with that, first of all, thank you for your patience with this podcast. Repeat listeners probably can tell that I'm in the throes of post-dental work. Unfortunately, it's that sort of dental work that seems to be the gift that keeps on giving and has lasted with me for about 5 days now. So that's why if you hear me lisping a little bit, that's what that's all about. I promise you, I certainly promise you, next month's podcast, I'll be over the dental work. I certainly hope so. So with that, thanks for tuning in and listening. Hope you consider the premium podcast. The first one we will release in about 2 weeks, and it will be the interview with Greg McGillivray about the Fair Labor Standards Act. And with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.